This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 23, 2006. I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington. In today's newscast, both President Bush and Deputy Director of National Intelligence Michael Hayden defend the domestic spying program. Kosovo's President Ibrahim Rugova died on Saturday, leaving a political vacuum as the Albanian government tries to negotiate for its independence. And the state of Washington considers a bill requiring new affordable housing to be built before existing low-income housing can be torn down. All these stories and more after these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Canadians are voting today in a special election. Today's election comes after a no-confidence vote caused the collapse of Prime Minister Paul Martin's government last November. Opinion polls predict the Conservative Party will win by a comfortable margin. Senate Democrats are conducting a hearing today into allegations that Halliburton failed to provide safe water to U.S. troops in Iraq. Zachary Jarvinen reports from Washington, D.C.
Details of a memo written by a Halliburton official, William Granger, on July 15th revealed that both civilian and military base camp populations had been exposed to an untreated and unsafe water source for possibly up to a year. Halliburton has denied the charges. However, their own former water expert, Bing Carter, had already tested and affirmed that the water was, quote, without question contaminated with numerous microorganisms, including coliform bacteria. Carter later resigned from his post after Halliburton officials would not take any action to inform the camp population. Halliburton, formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, received a number of no-bid contracts and has been repeatedly criticized for overcharging and underperforming. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Zachary Jarvinen.
Several explosions in southern Russia early Sunday morning have suspended gas and electricity supplies to Georgia and further strained the already tense relationship between the two countries. From Tbilisi, Deborah Wild reports.
All through the night and into the early morning hours, Georgians are queuing up for gas bottles. The government had announced that it would stop gas distribution for most of the country by Sunday evening. The beginning of the new school term, scheduled for today, has been postponed. Georgians use gas for heating and cooking, but the country has no gas storage and receives all its gas through Russia. President Mikhail Saakashvili is accusing Moscow of being behind these explosions as an attempt to blackmail Georgia. The Russian energy giant Gazprom is interested in buying Georgia's pipeline network in order to supply gas to Turkey. But Washington opposes such a deal, fearing it would make Georgia even more dependent on its northern neighbor. Moscow has discarded the Georgian allegations as hysterical while trying to transport gas to Georgia through an old pipeline from Azerbaijan, which has not been used in years. Estimates as to when gas supplies will be restored vary from days to weeks. Georgians are now preparing for some cold days as snow began to fall. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Deborah Wild in Tbilisi, Georgia.
In northeastern India, rebels have claimed responsibility for a series of explosions along an oil pipeline. Vinod Kejos reports.
10 bomb explosions and multiple grenade attacks killed 2 policemen and injured more than 30 people on Sunday in the northeastern Indian state of Assam. The United Liberation Force of Assam, or ULFA, has claimed responsibility for the attacks, saying they have waited too long for the government of India to begin peace talks. The area of India's northeastern states have many nationality groups, and each has their liberation armies to fight what they call Indian occupation. India has been dealing with the insurgency militarily for over 50 years. Some human rights records show more than 200,000 people lost their lives in the liberation movement of the Nagas and Assamese alone. The ULFA and 3 other groups in northeast India have called for a general strike on 26 January, India's Republic Day. The insurgent groups oppose the official celebrations, saying the Indian government is an occupying force. From New Delhi, in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has forced tens of thousands of people to flee the region in recent days. The United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, sent teams to the DRC-Uganda border region over the weekend. The agency estimates that around 20,000 Congolese had recently arrived in the area. Earlier today, 8 Guatemalan peacekeepers were killed during a gunfight with rebels along the Congolese border with Sudan. The acting UNHCR representative in Kampala, Uganda, said today that as many as 2,000 Congolese were returning to their homes, but that the situation is volatile and unpredictable. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration defended its program of wiretapping U.S. citizens through the National Security Agency, calling it lawful, limited, and necessary. It says that if the program was used prior to September 11th, the attacks may have been thwarted. Our D.C. editor, Leanne Caldwell, reports from Capitol Hill.
Surveilling people inside the United States is done only on those who are suspected of having ties with al-Qaeda, according to the Bush administration. President Bush defended surveillance activity to a supportive crowd at Kansas State University, saying that he will do whatever it takes to keep the United States safe and secure, calling it a terrorist surveillance program.
Because there's an enemy that still wants to harm the American people. What I'm talking about is the intercept of certain communications emanating between somebody inside the United States and outside the United States.
General Michael Hayden, Deputy Director of National Intelligence and former head of the National Security Agency, or NSA, also defended the program. He oversaw the expansion of domestic spying in 2001. He said that the policies had to change after September 11th because U.S. law protects any person inside the U.S., citizen or visitor, from being surveilled. The days following September 11th, the NSA got approval from their top legal counsel that expanding surveillance to include citizens was legal and constitutional. Yet Hayden was unable and unwilling to explain under which guidelines it was lawful to do so.
These guys are expert on the FISA Act. They're also really expert on the Constitution, and they're really expert on the Fourth Amendment. And so, you know, they weren't freebies. They just didn't hand out hall passes for anything that might have been operationally effective or some things the agency might have wanted to do.
FISA courts were created in 1978 as a quick way for intelligence agencies to obtain a warrant to spy on its citizens. But General Hayden said the FISA courts are less effective and that presidential powers trump the use of FISA.
If FISA worked just as well, why wouldn't I use FISA? There is an operational impact here. And I have two paths in front of me, both of them lawful, one FISA, one the president's authorization, and we go down this path because our operational judgment is it is much more effective.
Last week, the Department of Justice released a white paper defending the information gathering techniques used by the NSA. The 42-page document uses the Supreme Court decision, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, which ruled that congressional legislation passed in 2001 gave the president executive powers during a time of war. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed lawsuits challenging that, arguing that the government violated the First and Fourth Amendments, which protect freedom of speech and unreasonable search and seizures. John Conyers, ranking Democrat in the House Judiciary Committee, held hearings last week looking into the situation. Jonathan Turley, torture law professor at George Washington University, said the interpretation of presidential power goes beyond anything he's seen in the past.
The problem is that there is no limiting principle to the president's argument that he can effectively trump federal law. He's already said that he could violate the recent torture prohibition or ignore it in the interest of the country. He has said he can do so with a surveillance statute. He has said he can do so with enemy combatant detainees.
Senator Arlen Specter, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, will hold hearings investigating the program next month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Thousands of anti-abortion activists gathered in Washington, D.C. today to mark the 33rd anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. The activists used the gathering to also advocate for the confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court and replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, in the hope that Alito will lead the court in further chipping away at a woman's right to choose. The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote tomorrow on his confirmation, and pro-choice activists are engaged in a last-minute effort to convince Democratic senators to filibuster Alito's nomination. Ingrid Drake has more from the Capitol.
Yesterday was the 33rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion in the United States. While usually a day of mourning for anti-abortion groups, today their tone was confident that they had the political power to bring about their agenda, especially after a special guest called in live to their event.
The President of the United States.
One of my first acts as the President was to ban the use of taxpayer money on programs that promote abortion overseas.
Today's rally of between 5 and 10,000 people was dwarfed by the 1 million people that assembled for the pro-choice March for Women's Lives in 2004. Yet, the activists were confident that tomorrow, the Senate Judiciary Committee would endorse President Bush's Supreme Court nominee of Samuel Alito, leading to a full Senate vote. Congressman Christopher Smith of New Jersey is confident there will soon be a ban on third trimester abortions.
Before the ink was even dry on the president's signature, an activist federal judge usurped the legislative process and nullified the will of the people. It will likely soon be before the United States Supreme Court. The last time a similar bill was before the Supreme Court, we lost on a 5-4 vote, with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor casting the deciding vote. Well, she's retiring, and President Bush got to pick her replacement.
Alito's nomination can still be defeated, says Elliot Mintzberg, legal director at the People for the American Way.
Something like 1.1 million petition signatures have already been delivered in opposition to Alito, and the number of calls are going up every day. And as grateful as we are for everybody's participation, there's no question, though, that more is needed, given where we are now with a 55-45 Republican advantage, to have a real impact.
Planned Parenthood has coordinated an early morning demonstration in front of the Senate tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Ingrid Drake.
Bolivia has inaugurated its first indigenous president, Evo Morales, on Sunday. In his inaugural address, Morales pledged to end 500 years of injustice for his people. Morales, who is considered a strong critic of the United States, also reaffirmed his campaign pledge to nationalize the country's natural resources. Morales' victory was also celebrated with a traditional indigenous ceremony on Saturday. On Sunday, his inauguration was attended by an unprecedented number of dignitaries, including Brazil's Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva and Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. Free Speech Radio News' Deletta Varlesi reports from La Paz.
The first inaugural ceremony took place last Saturday in Tiwanaku ruins on the Andean mountains, where Morales received the traditional name as leader of the indigenous nation. It has been 514 years since this ceremony has been celebrated, and in this occasion it was held by four shamans representing the major indigenous populations that make up Bolivia: Aymara, Quechua, and the Guarani of the eastern regions. Valentin Maquillones, the shaman representing the Aymara people, which Morales belonged to, explains the meaning of the ceremony.
This is an offer for the whole world. It's an offer for the indigenous unity and integrity. We'll ask for peace, for harmony, equilibrium, and respect for all the beings existing in the cosmos we live in.
About 30,000 people attended the ceremony, most of them indigenous people, not just from Bolivia, but from North and South American countries as well. Doris Trujillo, an indigenous person from Ecuador, is part of National Assembly of Campesinos.
Within community issues, we are focusing the most on managing local municipalities. And this experience gives us the strength. This is a kind of experience that we can share with other indigenous people and bring as an example. There are municipalities that are working pretty good and are great examples of participative democracy. For instance, Cotacachi community is one of those in which participation is high and so is quality of life.
There were also representatives from North American indigenous community who were directly invited by Morales. They shared a spiritual vision for change foretold by many prophecies belonging to ancient original American cultures. Carol Perez Peterson was present as a representative of Northeastern American communities.
It's a historical moment for all the indigenous people of the world. First of all, that there is a president who understands the suffering of the indigenous people of his country because he lived it himself. And he understands the cultural pressures that the indigenous people have, just the difference on the inequality, the lack of respect, the taking of the land, all these things that occur from a dominant way of life that most most governments actually have set in motion to control people, to enslave them, and to have them to work for them.
In his speech in Tiwanaku, Morales reaffirmed the intent to be an example of an Indio president, not just for his people, but for all indigenous people in the world.
Today begins a new year for all native people in the world.
On Sunday, at the Congress Palace ceremony, attended by presidents from neighboring countries, including Hugo Chavez, Lula da Silva and Nestor Kirchner, Bolivia's Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera marked the intention of a government in which every Bolivian can feel represented, from business people to campesinos.
Never again will there be in Bolivia a state without indigenous people. The state is of everybody, of business people and chain workers, of campesinos and students. We want a strong state, multicultural, where different people, different languages, different interests can be joined together.
From the first time in South America's history, a president has officially been named as brother in a Congress session. From now on, the new administration will have to face the issues that are strongly urging, including nationalizing hydrocarbons and creating an assembly of native people to rewrite the state constitution with no exclusion. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese from La Paz, Bolivia.
The president of Kosovo, Ibrahim Rugova, died on Saturday after a six-month battle with lung cancer. He was 61 years old. The pacifist leader of the ethnic Albanian majority for the better part of 15 years, Rugova was considered by many to be a unifying element among an increasingly fractured Albanian-led government that is poised to gain some form of conditional independence in 2006. A UN-run province since the end of ethnic fighting in 1999, Kosovo is still technically part of the former Yugoslav successor state, Serbia and Montenegro. Tensions have elevated with Rugova's death, as the Albanian government must now negotiate its future without firm leadership. From Kosovo's capital of Pristina, Jackson Allers has this report.
For the last 2 days in Pristina, thousands of Albanians throughout the southernmost province of Serbia and Montenegro have been lining up outside the Kosovo Parliament building to pay their respects to President Ibrahim Rugova. Kosovo's Albanian-led government has called for a 15-day mourning period as it tries to decide how it will proceed as a unified negotiating team in ongoing UN-led status discussions. Jeta Jara is a political analyst and head of the Balkan Investigative Reporting Network of Kosovo.
For the international community, the most relevant power struggle and lack of leadership will be for the Kosovo negotiation team, because the international community cares far more to have the stable negotiation process about the status of Kosovo. And the problem for the international community at the moment is that there is nobody so evident to replace his function as the leader of this negotiation group.
Although, as Jara explains, the real negotiating position espoused by the former leader has not changed with his passing.
The pure strategy, Rugova's strategy, is not going to change. Everybody, all the Albanians, want independent Kosovo.
A literature scholar, Rugova was the leader of the Albanian nonviolent resistance movement in the 1990s, opposed to the rescinding of certain autonomous rights during the regime of former Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic. But members of the former guerrilla movement, the Kosovo Liberation Army, are now jockeying for power in the scramble to lead the Albanian negotiating team in what analysts widely believe will be some sort of conditional independence in 2006, a sure boost of popular power for anyone stewarding the process. Among the things that have been temporarily sidelined as a result of Rugova's death are the reforms of local government that would cede more power to the beleaguered ethnic Serbian minority, a population of approximately 100,000 that stayed in Kosovo following reprisal attacks by the Albanian majority after the end of NATO bombing in 1999. For their part, the Serbian government rejects any talk of independence, and their negotiating team sees the issue of government decentralization as key for the safety of the Kosovo Serbs, who have been subject to 6 years of isolation and ethnically motivated attacks. Milan Nikolic, director of the Belgrade-based Center for Studying Alternatives, said that Rugova's death jeopardizes this local governmental reform process, but he says Serbs see independence as the real thing to fear.
If there is no such provision, probably in case of independence of Kosovo or limited independence, whatever is the case, Serbs would probably move out of Kosovo, given the circumstances of great danger for the Serbs to live and work in Kosovo.
The current Kosovo parliamentary speaker, Nejat Daci, a member of President Rugova's majority political party, was appointed acting president. The negotiation process is set to restart in Vienna in February, and President Rugova's body will lie in state until his funeral on Thursday. Reporting from Pristina, this is Jackson Ellers with Free Speech Radio News.
23 people in Nepal were killed, mostly security forces and Maoist rebels, after hundreds of protesters clashed with police over the weekend. The demonstrators are calling on Nepal's king to give up complete authority over the country. It is estimated that as many as 500 people have been arrested. The king has sent about 20,000 soldiers to Kathmandu to stop the protesters. However, opposition leaders are calling for 3 more days of demonstrations. Free Speech Radio News' Carrie Byron is there and files this report.
The situation has deteriorated so much in Kathmandu over the past week that many can't remember the last time things were this bad. After having suffered through yet another security-related nighttime curfew Thursday evening, Kathmandu residents awoke to more bad news on Friday.
The Kathmandu and Lalitpur District Administration imposed curfew from 8 in the morning to 6 in the evening due to security concerns.
This curfew order is additional to the existing curfew order effective in the areas from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. every day imposed since January 18 and effective until further notice.
The Nepali government had concerns that soldiers from the country's decade-long Maoist insurgency would use a planned demonstration as cover to sneak into the capital. In fact, days before the rally was set to take place, Maoist leaders confirmed that insurgents had nothing to do with the protest. Nonetheless, government preparations for the demonstration were already going forward, and Thursday morning all phone lines were cut while government forces began mass arrests of political leaders.
They used armed forces, armed police. At the same time, they also used the plainclothes security forces. People were picked up from their bed.
That's Shabakar Budatoki, a human rights worker with the Defend Human Rights Movement of Nepal.
And at the same time, they have been arresting people and detaining for a while in police stations and have been transferring them to the armed police barracks. They are keep transferring the people, and we are not able to track the number of the people. But I would say at least there are hundreds of people still in detention.
Nepal has seen dozens of public pro-democracy rallies held both in and out of the capital since the king dissolved the government in 2002. But several new factors have led to explosive tensions, including 2 Maoist attacks the previous week on police stations on the outskirts of Kathmandu. On Thursday evening, just after the decision was made to impose the daytime curfew, Foreign Minister Ramesh Nathpandey explained to foreign diplomats the government's rationale.
The political parties have become beholden to the terrorists, as evidenced by the sudden increase in terrorist activities in and around the Kathmandu Valley and in other parts of the country.
But even more worrying for the government than terrorists is a mid-November agreement made between the political parties and the Maoists, who realize they are fighting a common enemy in the king. The regime is now faced with a loosely unified front consisting of not just the Maoists and political parties, but also much of civil society.
Therefore, the movement has gained legitimacy because everyone from jungle to civil society group was supporting the claims of the political parties. Therefore, government was being isolated.
Hari Sharma is a Nepali political scientist.
So government saw that particular attack as an attack on Kathmandu and created a fear psychosis among the people. In that respect, government wanted to mix the violent, the insurgency of Maoist and the peaceful demonstration of political parties.
What Sharma calls a fear psychosis has certainly affected many on the streets of Kathmandu. During the 3-hour interlude on Friday between the daytime and nighttime curfews, the vast majority of those interviewed in fact claimed support for the curfew, although not necessarily for the king.
Looking at the present condition of our country, I really support the curfew today, because today if there had been no curfew, there could have been anything. There would have been lots of fightings. The condition would be very bad, I think so.
Prashant Swist is a student in Kathmandu.
We have trusted political parties, we have trusted king also, but we didn't find the proper solution. I think we have been fed up of everything. Now what we want right now is the peace. That's what we want. That's it.
On Monday, opposition parties called for 3 more days of protests. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Carrie Byron in Kathmandu.
With about 20% cuts in subsidies for low-income housing since President Bush took office, affordable housing advocates are beginning to turn to the states for help. An amendment to proposed legislation in the state of Washington called the Affordable Housing for All Act would bar the Seattle Housing Authority from tearing down any low-income housing without first replacing all units at comparable rent. Martha Baskin has our story.
After decades of federal neglect, low-income housing advocates are turning to the state for legislation to prevent high-end redevelopment of one of the city's last remaining federally funded public housing complexes, Yesler Terrace.
Well, we see this bill as incredibly important because it would essentially go over the heads of the Housing Authority and local city council here.
Kate Villarreal, community organizer with the Community Coalition for Environmental Justice.
If there's support in the state legislature to kind of put these checks and balances on the Housing Authority, we would be able to, you know, sit back a little bit and we would have that protection in place that would achieve no net loss of housing here at Yesler Terrace, no displacement of residents, all the goals that we've been trying to negotiate for over the past 2 years.
The mission of public housing agencies to solely serve low-income populations began to change under Ronald Reagan. By 1995, under Clinton, redevelopment rules for replacing such housing were significantly altered to allow mixed use and high-end development. The ongoing trend has meant that federal housing subsidies originally earmarked for low income have been made available to housing authorities for market rate real estate development. Recent redevelopment of four Seattle public housing communities resulted in an estimated loss of 1,000 public housing units, according to John Fox with the Seattle Displacement Coalition.
We cannot afford to lose this public housing, and that's what SHA wants to do, is destroy it and replace it with expensive development, leaving only about probably roughly half or less the number of units that are currently there, public housing, low-income housing units.
Low-income housing advocates have been battling the Seattle Housing Authority, one of 200 across the country, for years. They turned to the state after failing to receive adequate support from the city council. The Housing Authority is lobbying the legislature to halt proposed language in the housing bill specific to Yesler Terrace. The Housing Authority's Virginia Felton.
The constraints that it would place on us would mean that we couldn't replace it unless it was replaced on site exactly as it is within 1 year, and that's makes it for an impossible constraint.
Felton says such a law would prevent the agency from accessing an array of funding, tax credit funding, bonds, state housing levies. She says the agency is in the process of replacing every unit of public housing that was lost in redeveloping other public housing communities. But Fox says the root of the problem is that the Housing Authority is tapping into existing low-income housing stock to rebuild units they tear down, rather than expanding the stock by building more low-income units.
Agencies across the country are doing this. Here in Seattle, though, we want to put a stop to the view of our Housing Authority that this is nothing but a piece of capital, that these units can be converted, torn down, redeveloped, turned into high-end condos.
Yesler Terrace is one of Seattle's few remaining public housing communities. Built as a shining jewel of what the New Deal could do for the less fortunate, the valuable public housing is perched on a hill overlooking downtown with panoramic views of Mount Rainier and the Olympic Mountains. Resident Audrey Breaux says the Housing Authority wants Yesler Terrace for the people that work downtown.
Well, you can just walk down the hill, ride the bus to the free zone, get off and walk home. See, but it's not fair to the low-income families. And it's taken me a while to get here in this Yesler Terrace. It's taken me over 30 years. They can upgrade it, but don't tear it down. Because if we do, we never would be back in here.
The issue is bound to remain heated as the city's demand for affordable housing continues to grow. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Free Speech Radio News is an independent program. Filling in for Aldo Bogado, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.